Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Blake Radio Network with Rainbow Soul, and today is Tuesday, March 25th, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And today's topic is, who's in that white coat anyway? What's that person thinking? They're happy, sad? Do they use the unproven therapies that they tell you not to use? Have they healed themselves? And are they qualified to heal you? What I'm going to do today is take a look behind the scenes and answer these questions and maybe even a few more. And also talk about natural options that you have to avoid, of course, the hazards of medical therapy or medical intervention. Now, a lot of times, we citizens or patients are told that doctors are somehow objective, somehow separate from their, human condition. When actually, it's not the case. Doctors are human beings, and their happiness or unhappiness often spills over into your care and can influence it. So tonight, I'm going to go behind the scenes and share with you information from a family medicine survey, a survey of family practice doctors, and actually all doctors as well. And what we're going to look at is the characteristics of these doctors and then talk about how these features might impact the care that you receive and how you are received and how you can prevent yourself in a different light or pick a different doctor to get a better outcome. Before I go much further, I'd like to say if people would like to listen on the phone line, you can call 914-338-0695. And, of course, we have a chat room going, which is Healing with Dr. Daniels at drtangles.com. I think that's it. I'll have to check with my chat room director in a minute here and he'll give me the latest information. So, let's start. The first thing they did was they did a survey and surveyed 27,000 doctors. So we'll call that a reasonable sample. And they looked at family physicians and their lifestyle. The report is in 2014 based on 2013 data. And what they found is, just by the way, in the United States, somewhere around 35% of the population is obese. And obesity, of course, is considered to be not a good thing. Now, in family practice doctors, there's a 48% rate of obesity / being overweight. This is interesting. This means if you want to lose weight, you definitely, family practice is not your specialty. To boost women trim, that would be the dermatologist. So if you're trying to lose weight, A family practice doctor is not likely to be able to help you simply because he's overweight. He or she is overweight himself. Very, very interesting. And next, they ask these physicians, who is more overweight, men or women? And believe it or not, it's pretty even. It's really pretty even. Only thing you can say about the doctors is they're not underweight. But once you get overweight, you know, the men are mildly overweight, and then when you get into serious obesity, the men and women are just about equal. There's not any disparity there. You're pretty much going to get not much help depending on gender. And the next thing they ask these people is what diet do they choose? This is interesting because you can actually take away information about this concerning non-physicians. What they do is they ask these physicians what diet they're following, and then they correlated this with who was the most overweight. What they found then was doctors following the typical American diet, 40% of them were underweight, and 20% of them were normal weight. In other words, if they followed a normal American diet by their own admission, they were twice as likely to be overweight. It gets even better. So they followed the American Heart Association diet, they were actually more likely to be normal weight. So 25% following that diet were normal weight, and 15% who follow their diet were overweight. So you still have some people weighing in and being overweight. Then there's a Mediterranean-type diet. Now, those of you who are into alternative medicine and you're following the discussion, the Mediterranean diet is so varied that it's difficult to know what that might be, but I guess we can say that if you're following a Mediterranean diet, there's certain things that you will not eat, whatever that might be. And we find doctors are following the Mediterranean diet that, again, more of them have normal weight. That normal weight is like 21%, and the ones following the fat ones are 12%. So the way this works is all the underweight add up to 100 and all the overweight add up to 100. And what about weight loss? If you're on the weight loss calorie counters diet, you are more likely to be overweight, fat. These are doctors, and it's assumed that they're human like anyone else. So doctors following the Weight Watchers calorie-counting, calorie-reducing diet are more likely to be overweight. Now, you can say that's observational bias. Maybe people who are overweight are more likely to go on that kind of diet, but certainly it's not a dramatically effective diet. The paleo diet. If the paleo diet seems to be neck and neck, if you follow a paleo diet, you're just as likely to be, as a doctor, overweight as underweight. If you follow meals on the go, you're twice as likely to be overweight as normal weight. Lacto-ovo-vegetarian, this is interesting. So the lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet, where they eat eggs and chicken, does not appear to be any better for having a normal weight than eating the American Heart Association diet or the Mediterranean diet. There's a definitely substantial reduced risk of being overweight or obese, but it's not great. Gluten-free diet, same thing. And believe it or not, the vegan diet. A little bit of overweight people following the vegan diet. I attribute that to the processed vegan foods. That just because a person is vegan does not mean that what they're eating is free of chemicals and poisons. And then there's the Amish-style diet, which ranks right up there with the vegan diet. This is very, very interesting. Most doctors follow the typical American diet. I should say more doctors follow that diet than any other diet. So if you go to a doctor and you ask, hey, what diet should I follow? You're going to get the answer, typical American diet. That's the diet followed by most doctors. Very, very interesting. And so if you're going to ask the doctor about some kind of healing diet, he's basically going to tell you, eat a typical American diet and cut back. So this is not a reasonable source of information here. The next thing they ask these doctors is, what about family doctors? Is how often do they eat out? This is another very revealing question. For these doctors, several thousand doctors were asked, how often do you eat out? People who eat out frequently, like daily, were more likely to be overweight or obese. That's interesting. People eat out once a week were still more likely to be obese. Once you got down to a couple times a month, they only eat out a couple times a month, more people were likely to be normal or underweight. Now, I have to say normal because the frequency of being underweight in lung physicians is less than 2%. So they say underweight, but it's just not that many underweight physicians. And people would say rarely, less than once a month, again, were more likely to be normal weight. So to increase your odds of having normal weight, you have to eat out either once a month or two times a month. That's it. Once a week definitely puts you in the overweight class. That's very interesting. And these are types of surveys and things we don't do in the regular population, so we don't really get this kind of information. But I'll say from my personal experience in working with many people who have serious health afflictions and serious weight problems, for many of them, they experience near miraculous results just when they stop eating out. Stop eating out, the weight falls off, arthritis goes away, fatigue goes away, a lot of things clear up. So just eating out has a profound effect, even with doctors. You can see that here. And so then they ask, where do these people eat out? This is another very revealing trend in terms of weight. So if you want to be overweight, eat at an institutional cafeteria. That would be the hospital cafeteria. And since I've eaten at a hospital cafeteria and I've seen this food on my patient's plate, I will tell you the food in the hospital cafeteria is far superior to what the patients get on the plate. And if the food in the hospital cafeteria is fattening and obesity-causing, that's definitely a sign. So hospital cafeteria, that will put you overweight. Fast food, you're more likely to be overweight if you eat fast food. And then if you eat at a middle-level chain, I'm not sure what that means, but a middle-level chain, I guess, would be any hospital, any restaurant that has several outlets. It's not a unique restaurant. Then there's mid-level local restaurant. That would be like a diner. So if you eat a mid-level chain, you're more likely to be overweight. If you eat at a local restaurant, chances of being obese, of being overweight, are actually even. That's what they found among doctors. And the doctors who ate at high-end, fine dining restaurants were more likely to be normal weight. Interesting. It's not clear if that's because eating $50 meals is going to mean you're going to eat them less often, in which case you're really eating less often, but if they ate at the fine dining places more frequently, would they still be overweight? So there's a little confounding factor there. But the point here is that if you're going to eat at a restaurant, the more expensive the restaurant, the less likely you are to be overweight. Now, my observation with this experience with restaurants is that higher-end restaurants tend to have less chemicals in the food. And so the higher-end, more expensive restaurants in New York City, for example, purchased organic vegetables at above retail prices from our organic farmers in Syracuse, New York. So literally, these high-end, fine dining restaurants were themselves paying top dollar for organic vegetables. So if I was organic farmers, and, you know, to get my crowd, I'd say, oh, Dr. Daniels, They don't have any vegetables. What do you mean they don't have vegetables? They have this big farm, they're growing all this stuff. Where's this stuff going? He said, well, you know, to be honest with you, these same farmers are telling them to buy locally. Well, we sell it downstate in New York City. Those restaurants are willing to pay so much money for these vegetables, we just sell everything to them. And so here I was in Syracuse, New York, trying to buy local, support my local organic farmer, and they were selling all their produce in New York City, 6 hours away, to the higher-end restaurants who were willing to pay more than what they could get from the local population in Syracuse. So there's a message in there somewhere. I'm not sure what it is, but I leave that for you. So the point is this. If you're going to eat out, you're better off going to a fine dining restaurant, paying through the nose, but just a lot less frequently. And that's very interesting. I'm living here in Panama. I feel like it's the same thing. Fine dining restaurants buy all of their stuff from the organic farmers, or vegetables are organic, or meats they buy from the farmers who don't use drugs and pesticides. Very, very interesting. I think they really do make an effort there. Now, lifestyle reports. Who takes supplements? Ooh, this is the part we want to get to. Which of these doctors are taking a supplement? Which family physicians are taking supplements? Turns out that the people who are taking supplements, if you look at the age, younger doctors actually take fewer supplements. Younger doctors, half, or 53%, more than half, of young physicians that's under 45 take supplements. Older physicians who are 46 and older, it's 62% take supplements. As far as men goes, if you have a male doctor that you're going to see, 53% of male doctors take supplements. Female doctors, 63% of them take supplements. This is really new. I just got an email today from someone who said that they didn't take supplements for a long time because their doctor told them that they were just making extensive urine. And if you're, well, you know, I don't want to throw my money down the toilet. And so they didn't buy supplements. And recently they started taking supplements and they felt a little better. So in a recent Gallup poll, when we looked at people who took supplements, nearly one half of all Americans take some form of supplement. That's nearly one half, which means less than half of Americans. And this is their survey that they're doing. When they did a survey on regular non-doctors, less than half of the ones they surveyed are taking supplements. And so the disparity is, that 61% of family doctors over 46 years old who answered the survey take supplements. And 53% of family physicians, 45 and under. But if you look at gender, as I said before, 63% of women report taking supplements. This is absolutely outrageous. So doctors are telling their patients not to take supplements, and they are taking supplements themselves. And even they checked among nurses, too, 71 to 88%. That's huge. So a lot of supplement use going on among these people who exclusively recommend prescription drugs to the public. Very interesting. So if they're taking supplements, what supplements are family doctors taking? Well, that's interesting. So it seems that doctors, in terms of their supplement taking, 31% of male doctors and 38% of female physicians report taking a multivitamin. And so it's similar among the regular U.S. population. However, more women are taking vitamin D and calcium than men. Now, if you will recall, women are advised to take vitamin D and calcium for their bones, for osteoporosis. And also calcium, taken in a supplement form, is not bioavailable and actually not very helpful. So while these doctors are taking supplements, it seems they may be relying more on conventional medical guidelines than any kind of varied source. So it seems the doctors are limiting their source of supplement information to the same source that they're using for medical information in general. So this is really huge. So what else are they taking? They're also taking omega-3 fatty acids, which is interesting. It's about 23%. And despite a lack of evidence supporting the value of antioxidant supplements, 20% of men and 17% of women, family physicians, are using them, even though there's absolutely no evidence supporting the value of antioxidant supplements. This is in the doctor literature, the doctor bubble, so to speak. And 11% are taking coenzyme Q10 to prevent statin-related myalgia. This is interesting. So 11% of doctors, of men, male family practice doctors, 9% of female family practice doctors, are taking statins, and they're taking coenzyme Q10 to prevent statin-related aches and pains. And this is what the doctors wrote down themselves in this survey. Very interesting. And they're also talking about complementary alternative medical therapies. So we're going to get to that part two. And that's another very revealing piece of information in terms of what the doctor's doing and what are they telling you to do. Okay, so which doctors are using complementary or alternative treatments? Well, if you have a female doctor, just 63% chance that she's using a complementary alternative treatment. As far as a male doctor, chances are only 45%. So if you're talking to a physician and you're trying to weigh whether or not to share your complementary or alternative medicine practices, you might be better off sharing that information with a female doctor instead of a male doctor. You have more sympathy, I guess would be the word. And it turns out that doctors who are younger tend to use alternative therapy. 53% of younger doctors, young being under 45, and 51% or 50% of 46 and older. So the youth is greater among the younger doctors, but not that much. So this is very enlightening that family physicians are using complementary and alternative treatments literally at a pretty high rate, at a rate that, of more than half overall. And so what they're finding out is they are saying, well, this is what the doctors say. Their studies concerning alternative therapies are disappointing, and they're not based on any biological principle. In fact, they seem to hark back to a much more distant time before we really understood the pathophysiologic basis of disease and were able to direct treatments towards them. And so despite such limited evidence, 38% of adults say they are using some form of alternative medicine, according to the National Committee on Alternative Medicine. Now, this is shocking that 38% of adults in the United States are using alternative medicine, yet use among doctors is so much higher. And so let's see what the, as high as 62% for women. This is actually shocking. So these people are prohibited from prescribing complementary alternative therapies for yourself, but they are taking them themselves. The question becomes, well, what are they doing? Well, they're doing, in this study, glucosamine chondroitin is considered some alternative therapy. And usually they're doing this for arthritis. So doctors are finding that the conventional therapy for arthritis has failed in their own personal lives. and they're using the coaching and chondroitin. They're also using yoga, meditation, and tai chi. And so the most common reason for people to go to the doctor is pain. And so doctors are using complementary alternative therapies for their pain and recommending surgery and dangerous pain medicines like narcotics and NSAIDs for your pain. So this is really shocking. I just want to say you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniel on the Rainbow Soul Network at BlakeRadio.com. And to tune in is 914-338-0395. We'll be taking questions in about 15 minutes. And if you want to join the live chat in our chat room, it's healingwithdrdaniel.chattangle.com. And so the next thing to look at is which doctor to take the patient. This is important because a lot of times when you come to the doctor and you are just chatting, you might talk about maybe a vacation you just took. And it could be that this idle chatter on your part might strike an incredible amount of envy or even resentment on the part of the doctor who himself may not be taking vacations or may not be able to. So let's see who takes vacation. And so the question they asked the doctors was, do you take more than 4 weeks of vacation per year? That would be like 4 weeks in one day. And so who they find had little or no vacation. First of all, they found that doctors of diabetes doctors, endocrinology doctors, about 12% of them had more than 4 weeks of vacation. This is interesting because a lot of doctors who are endocrinologists and diabetologists, they've been at this for several years. And to have only 12% be able to take 4 weeks of vacation a year is a little disappointing. But family doctors fall right behind that at about 12 or 13% taking vacation. Compared to anesthesiology, where half of all anesthesiologists take more than 4 weeks vacation. I probably didn't even ask about beyond 50% because that was all they could measure. So anesthesiologists and radiologists tend to take more vacations. We want to take a look here and find out where the dermatologists are because we're going to later find out that the dermatologists are the happiest guys on the block. And about 15 or 18% of them take 4 weeks or more of vacation a year. So the point of this is, if you're a person who takes lots of vacations, you can share that information with your anesthesiologist, your radiologist, your pathologist, or even your cardiologist, who tend to take that many vacations. But the rest of the specialists tend not to take so many vacations. They really don't have much vacation time, and they even feel kind of tied or chained to their practice. I'd say change the subject to something else besides your vacation. All right. And what else did they ask? They asked about volunteers. This is really interesting. Do doctors volunteer, and how much do they volunteer? About 24% of doctors say that they never volunteer for anything. This is interesting. It might be because they don't have time to volunteer, or because they're working so many hours. You know, back when I was practicing medicine, I generally volunteered anywhere from 5 to 10 hours a week, depending. I volunteered for the Vegetarian Society. I volunteered for the Medical Society. I really volunteered for just about anyone who asked me. But it's interesting that 24% of doctors never volunteer for anything. Some volunteer for medical disasters. Men are more likely to do that. Others volunteer for the foundation. Equally likely, men will do that. And I did some foundation work for the YMCA and that kind of stuff. We've done medical military reserve, men are more likely to do that. Tutoring and counseling, men are more likely to do that. But work associated with school, the female doctors are more likely to volunteer for school. And it sounds like volunteering for schools or children attended. Things are interesting because if you have something you volunteer for or like, it would be better to pick a doctor, if you're going to see a doctor, who has a similar volunteer interest as you. A lot of times, this will evoke more sympathy and make the doctor feel a greater affiliation with you and make him more willing to withhold harmful therapy or warn you away from harmful therapy. About 8% work with the homeless. Actually, I volunteered to work with the homeless, too, when I was in practice. Work with religious organizations. Men and women are equally likely to do that. International mission work. Men and women are equally likely to do that in terms of positions. And free local clinic work. I did that as well. In this case, male doctors are more likely than female doctors to do this. The problem I found with pro bono and local clinic work when I volunteered was I was volunteering my time for free, but the clinic was charging the government $100 per person that I saw. And there was the clinic, although it was a free pro bono clinic, would not allow anyone without insurance to be seen. And when I found that out, I was tremendously disappointed because I was looking for a place to send my patients who couldn't afford to see me in the office, where I could, you know, see them there, and it would be free, but not so. Let's find out more about these doctors. Are family doctors happier at home or at work? This is interesting because it kind of dovetails into future slides. So it turns out that the happiness at home, so people who were extremely happy were happiest at home. So the extremely happy doctors were only like 15% of doctors, and they were happy more at home. A minority of the extremely happy doctors were happy at work. Very happy doctors were much happier at home. Somewhat happy doctors, again, more of them were somewhat happy at work. As you get into neutral, equally happy at work and home, the work went out. The people who were somewhat unhappy tended to have more happiness at work. They were very unhappy. Still, they were happier at work. People were extremely unhappy were happier at work. So it seems that a doctor who is happier at work or happiest at work is likely to be overall an unhappy camper. So this is very interesting. It might say that doctors are aware that there's something very negative about their work. Who knows? They might be aware that they're harming people. And then they go on to talk about which doctors are happier. It turns out that family doctors are right there in the middle of the pack. And middle of the pack means 60% of family physicians say that they are happy. And of those who say they're happy, most of them are happy at home. Very few, 35%, are happy at work. Now that's a real bell ringer there. So if you're going to see a family practice physician, what you're going to find is that chances are, more likely than not, doesn't want this job. Now, that's worth knowing. If you're seeing a doctor who hates his job, there's two ways to play that. If you're seeing a family practice doctor who hates his job, he might hate his job because he likes to give patients a break and he can't. And he might like his job because he's sadist. So I would say, if you have a family practice doctor, you're going to go see a family practice doctor, ask him, hey, you like your work? He says, oh, I don't know, I don't like all these regulations that interfere with patient care. You might want to, that might be a more approachable doctor in terms of asking them, hey, would you consider vitamin C, or what do you think about vitamin C, or something like that. So these are not happy campers, your primary care doctors. Also, I say, well, what about What about other specialties? Well, critical care, the intensive care unit doctors are the least happiest doctors, followed by AIDS doctors, followed by internal medicine doctors. So these are not happy campers. And I don't know if you want to be around all that negative energy when you're trying to heal. Now, what about exercise? You know, doctors, we are told to tell everyone that exercise is the solution. Exercise is the answer. If you exercise, it'll fix this, it'll fix that. So what do doctors do? Are doctors themselves exercising? Are they taking this piece of information or advice? And I say doctors who exercise at least twice a week. It seems to be really 50-50, half exercise and half don't. And of the underweight doctors, 53% exercise twice a week. For normal weight doctors, 72% exercise twice a week. And the overweight doctors, 60% exercise twice a week. In other words, being underweight or normal weight does not seem to correlate well with exercise. So the overweight people, that 50% exercise is very similar to the underweight and normal, which is between basically 55 and 70. So just like us regular folks, exercise does not seem to have a particularly beneficial effect on exercising. And so that's interesting. So even though we're taught to tell everyone exercise, 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 it doesn't seem to be really helping. Now, this is interesting. Which doctors rate their health as good to excellent? Among family doctors, although they rate their health as among the worst, 88% say that their health is good to excellent. Now, get this. If their health is so good, how come they use complementary alternative medicine, 58% of them? Yeah, interesting, isn't it? So they're very optimistic when describing their own health, even in the face of contradictory evidence, which might also explain why they so easily discount the complaints of patients. Like, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. When I have is excellent, and I have the same aches and pains. Interesting. Now, how much do they drink per week, alcohol? Seems like doctors don't drink very much. More than two drinks per week, very few doctors, less than 3%. Two drinks a week, less than 7%. One drink a week, 10% of doctors. Fewer than one drink a week, 45% of physicians. I don't drink, 30% of physicians. So 30 and 45, so 75% of physicians drink fewer than one alcoholic drink per week. Very interesting. As a physician who went down to zero drinks, from two drinks a week to zero drinks, I can tell you, when I was in medical school, at one point I was drinking two drinks a week, which I felt to be drinking. And I had to quit because I needed the extra time to study. I couldn't tolerate being tired for 3 or 4 hours after drinking. And I think many other doctors might have the same situation, that they're working so many hours that there's not room to drink. Not that it's good or bad, but it's just not fun for them. Another thing is that if you tell a doctor that you're drinking one drink a week or two drinks a week, you have 80% of doctors who might look down their nose at you and suggest that you're abusing alcohol. So if you'll, I won't say cage your cautious, but if you do drink, obviously you want to, if you're going to take a prescription drug, you want to let the doctor know or ask him, does this medication mix with alcohol or not? Or you might want to get that as a stop. But you're not going to find much acceptance, and you might even find a very judgmental attitude among physicians. Or better yet, you might want to pick a doctor who's drinking a habit parallel to your own. One thing about doctors is doctors are conditioned to be very judgmental and to judge other people by how similar other people are to them. So doctors are, if the doctor drinks a certain amount, he's likely to think that his alcohol intake is fine. Anyone who drinks what he drinks or less is an okay alcohol consumption. So definitely pick a doctor whose alcohol intake is similar to yours, or keep your alcohol intake to yourself. That's important. Next, what about physicians and having the most savings? They asked the doctors if they had adequate savings, if they felt their savings were adequate. Very subjective test. A question, but do they think their savings are adequate? And so what the doctor said, doctors, only 68% felt that their savings were adequate. What does that tell you? It tells you that as a specialty, family practices tend to feel that they need more money. And the corollary is that they might be more influenced by your insurance and other incentives. So that's an interesting thing to be aware of. And so if you're going to use your insurance, definitely read your insurance contract to see the pressures they're putting on your doctor, if they're going to put pressure on your doctor at all. So are male or female physicians religious or spiritual? Basically, as a group, 80% say that they are spiritual, and about 60% are actually practicing their religion. I'm not sure how this pans out with society at large, but the issue here is if your religion is different from the doctor's religion, that can create serious conflict in terms of the physician feeling that your religion might constitute superstition. So I would say as far as doctor's concerned, it's better to either not declare your religion until you find out what the doctor's religion is, and then only if your religion is similar to his. And here is another question to ask. Where do family doctors vary on your political spectrum? This is important for you to know, because a lot of times you go see a doctor for political reasons. When I say political reasons, I mean the society or the government has invested in the doctor certain powers, and their political powers. And whether or not the doctor is willing to exercise his political power on your behalf has to do often with the doctor's political spectrum or his preconceived notions about whether that benefit is legitimate or not. So they decided they weren't going to ask the doctors if they were Democrat or Republican or independent, and instead they focused on whether members considered themselves liberal or conservative in fiscal and social areas. So the responses are subjective, obviously, but I think it's really important to get a handle on this. So with 58% of women and 48% of men claiming to be socially liberal. Now, what does that mean, socially liberal? Socially liberal means they believe the government should pay for this. They believe the government should pay for that. They believe in the welfare state. So if you're going to the doctor to access the benefit of the welfare state, when I say the welfare state, I mean maybe an insurance claim or disability or something like that, you're better off seeing a female doctor. Female doctor's going to say, oh, yes, disability, of course, it's something everyone is entitled to. And this person is more likely to help you or assist you in getting what's called a benefit. On the other hand, 71% of men say that they are conservative, they're fiscal conservative. What does that mean? That means if you are seeking from the doctor a conservative bent, then he's more likely to comply. So let's say you're self-employed, you need a permit from the government to operate in your type of business. If you see a male doctor, he's more likely to stretch things, if that's what you need done, to help you get this certificate that you need to qualify yourself, say, to run your business. For example, my practice, even though I was female, I had a Christian company who wanted to get a taxi license to support himself, to earn money. course, he was 92 years old, but that's beside the point. And so he would do better seeing a fiscally conservative doctor. A conservative doctor who felt everyone should work, everyone should support themselves, the government shouldn't subsidize people. So that's the kind of view that a kind of doctor he would want to pick. If he went to a left-wing or liberal, socially liberal doctor, that doctor would say, you know, you'd rather have, you're 92, collect your Social Security and be done with it. And so it really impacts how a doctor treats you and what benefits the doctor will or will not assist you in accessing in terms of the doctor's political leaning. So that's important to know. And there's another thing to ask doctors, are they likely to marry? And you'd say, well, what does it matter if a doctor is likely to marry? And it actually turns out it can really impact your care. When I was practicing medicine, I was not married. I was single, and I had several children. And it turns out that most doctors are 70% male, are in their first marriage. And so they take a pretty dim view of things like remarriage and divorce. And I didn't think this was really a huge deal. So one day, a lady came into my office, and she was really upset. She brought her kid in to see me. And so I asked her, how come she switched doctors? And she says, well, my last doctor felt that since I was divorced, I was an unfit mother, and that I should not be working outside the home. So it's really important to realize how doctors' biases can play into your care, and often it does in more important ways than you can even imagine. And this particular lady, she, you know, had to work to support her child because, you know, she was the only, you know, a parent. And so doctors, we're trained in medical school, by the way, to be totally biased against single parents of any kind. Things may have changed since I left the profession. But this is still the case. It's very much a bias. You can see in their own practices, 70% are on their first marriage, whereas in the United States, half of all marriages end in divorce. It's really interesting. Now, we also mentioned which doctors are, I don't know if we talked about which doctors are overweight. But family practice doctors are definitely not skinny mini, as we mentioned. So you're not the ones you want to consult in your let's take a look and see if we have any questions in our chat room. Someone in the chat room asked what profession, what religion doctors tend to have. In the survey, they did not mention what religion doctors tended to have. I can just mention my particular medical school, University of Pennsylvania, although it's not a reasonable sample, a representative sample, because some medical schools like Loma Linda is Seventh-day Adventist, but my particular medical school was mostly Jewish. And there are other medical schools with other predominant religions. So I think the interesting thing is that whatever religion doctors are, they tend to be practicing that religion as opposed to just giving it lip service. More than half of all doctors do that. All right, so another question is, Dr. Daniels, when you practiced medicine, were you happy at work? Absolutely, because I made all the rules. I was in private practice, and I made the rules. If something happened I didn't like, I would make a rule to address it. So I was extremely happy, and, of course, I was happy at home, too, because I made the rules, and I wanted to be happy. So if something happened that made me unhappy, then I would just make a rule that would address it. Let's see if we have more questions. What about the suicide rate among doctors? This study did not talk about the suicide rate among doctors. However, they're finding that doctors who are happiest at work were the least happy, and that doctors who found most of their happiness in work were very unhappy, suggests that there's something about the work situation or the work condition that leaves doctors feeling pretty unhappy. So it's not clear to me what they think that is. Although I'll tell you, once I figured out that I was murdering people, I was really not happy with that. I was really concerned, and I was just looking for some compromise here. Like the standard of care is murderers are killing people, and I don't want to, you know, I didn't sign up to be a murderer. And so my compromise was to give everyone a choice and to let them choose. And that worked out fast, it turned out, because the death rate, I call it, but the death rate went to zero. So that was my solution. But I was very unhappy with the idea of harming people. And I think many doctors are unhappy with that, but they don't perceive any way out. Okay, we have a question. Let's look here. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Hi.
Yes.
By the way, my name is Celine. I'm calling from New York. Yes.
Okay.
I was diagnosed with like congestive heart failure, and they said I have a leaky heart valve, and I also have a slightly enlarged heart. Is there anything that can be done about, you know, the condition?
Yeah, absolutely. I had a patient who had enlarged heart. Actually, he had alcoholic cardiomyopathy was his problem, but a lot of things cause it. But generally, an enlarged heart leaky valve is caused by dietary considerations.
Is it dietary?
There's something you're eating or dietary practice that's causing your heart to enlarge. And when the heart enlarges, the ring that holds the valve separates, and you get a leakage. Once the enlargement reverses, the valve comes back together, and the leak goes away. So what I would recommend is sending an email to support@vitalitycapsules.com. And then
I'm so sorry. I didn't hear the information, the website.
support@vitalitycapsules.com.
Support?
Yes, support at vitalitycapsules.com.
Okay, capsule.com.
Okay. And I do work with a small number of people. So what Gabriel will do is send you an email with an application to fill out. I'll take a look at it. I'll figure out if I'm able to help you or not. If I am, then we'll have another conversation. If not, then I'll let you know what I think you should do instead.
Oh, okay. Well, I so appreciate that, Doctor. And I'll definitely be in touch.
Okay, great.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Now, cardiologists, believe it or not, even though cardiologists are extremely high earners, they are unhappy. And probably cardiologists are so unhappy because they have such a high death rate. Not among cardiologists, among the patients. And so that is a real consideration in terms of people and their happiness, or doctors and their happiness. And many doctors do realize that there's something wrong, although there's different levels of articulating what's wrong and trying to figure out what to do to remedy it. I think that's all the questions in the chat room. So let's take a look at next week's show. I closed that window, and so it's a bit lost. So next week, what are we going to talk about? Oh, let's take a look at the recently closed windows. Why prescribing drugs can never be safe. So next week we're going to talk about why prescribing drugs can never be safe. I'm going to go over the information that's needed to prescribe a drug safely and how your doctor does not have any of that information about any of the drugs you prescribe and how you can get the information if you choose to take drugs and how you can get the same information about supplements if you choose to take supplements. So it's why prescribing drugs can never be safe. And so that's what we're going to talk about next week. I also want to give an update on Vitality Capsules. Vitality Capsules are on their way. We had a difficulty with our company that was grinding the herbs. And herbs, and they will be put in capsules forthwith in the course of the next week. So they have to arrive at the manufacturer and get put in the capsules. So I was hoping I could get freshly ground herbs, but in America, that's not possible. Any other questions? Well, you're on the air.
Hi, my name's Edita. I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio. I'm just new to your information. I'm so glad I found you. But
great.
I know I'll probably get the answer to my question if I looked at more of your information, but I just wanted to ask, on blood pressure, what do you think that, you know, from what I've read that, you know, they don't know where high blood pressure comes from, and I just want to see what do you think that is a result of?
Oh, okay. All right, great.
Would help that.
Okay. So the question was, what's causing hypertension and what would help that? In medicine, every single disease, the medical position is we don't know what causes it. It's incurable. Take this drug and take it for life. And got to the point where I was just my brain just got totally bored because every patient, that's what I was supposed to say, we don't know why you have it. You have it. It's a drug, take it the rest of your life, and see me every 3 months the rest of your life so I can adjust and monitor the drug. Well, with hypertension, what causes hypertension is there's a block in the circulation, and the blood is not able to circulate to vital organs. Not just any organs, but actually two organs. Your circulation is designed to take blood to only two places, your brain and your kidneys. That's it. Every place else, there is no monitoring system in your body to monitor the circulation to it. And so if there's not enough brain going to your heart or your kidneys, there's a feedback loop to your heart saying, work harder, pump harder, pump harder. So we need a drug to tell your heart to stop pumping that actually makes your underlying disease worse. And so I did do a show, Heart Disease Hoax, which goes into it in tremendous detail. But most of the blood pressure medicines actually make your disease worse. And there is absolutely no evidence that blood pressure medications extend anyone's life. So that's the summary on heart disease and hypertension. And again, it's a diet. You can change your diet. You can do cleansing, take herbs. There's all those options that you can do. Many of those are covered in my prior recording, Heart Disease Hoax. And so you can check that out. And you can go to vitalitycapsules.com. And opt in there, and then you'll get a free report on the free report is how to avoid antibiotics. And believe it or not, that is linked also to hypertension. So we only have 30 seconds left, so I'll see you next week, and we're going to find out next week on why drugs can never be safe. I won't say drugs, medication can never be safe. So we will see you then.